Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. So today's sutta is the Nalakapana Sutta, and the main reason why I wanted to read this out today is basically one reason, just to make the point that it is the five hindrances of Pajjaniwamana that is what feeds delusion and keeps delusion going. And those five hindrances, they are only suppressed for long periods of time enough for a person to see the Dhamma, in other words, to stop the delusion, avijja, from lasting too long. They're only stopped, suppressed by the four jhanas. I know I sometimes emphasize this and you may get fed up with it, but there are some teachers, they still say, no, you don't need the jhanas, no, you can still become enlightened without them. And that's just a total, what we call in Buddhism, or what I call in Buddhism, gomayang. Now, you know what the word gomayang means? Pali word. Go is a word for a male cow, a bull. And mayang is what comes out of the backside of a bull. So what does gomayang mean? Yeah, one or two people got it. Because sometimes you've got to be polite with your words, sometimes. So I say it in Pali, and people sort of understand, but I don't get in trouble. So anyway, the Nalakapana Sutta. Thus have I heard. Why did they always say, thus have I heard? Because what they were doing, they were remembering, putting down things which they'd heard in their life, those first 500 arahats, things they had heard for posterity. So this is what they would say, thus I have heard. And to make sure it was located in, as the Buddha's words, or in the right time, they then say, on one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the coastal and country at Nalakapana in the Palasa Grove. Sometimes then they would go off to almost another story happened at that time in which the Buddha was not involved. But in this one, the Buddha was still alive. He was staying in the coastal and country at Nalakapana in the Palasa Grove. And the coastal country, that was around Sarvati. Sarvati was the capital of the coastal country. And the monastery very close by was Jetavana, yeah, and Artapindika's Park. So, on that occasion, many very well-known clansmen, they called them clansmen, it means they were monks, basically, had gone forth out of faith from their home life into homelessness under the Blessed One. And the first three was Venerable Anuruddha, the Venerable Nandiya, and the Venerable Kimbala, who we mentioned in the Upakalesa Sutta. The Venerable Bhagu, and remember that Bhagu was the monk the Buddha first went to see after he left Kosambi. The Venerable Kundahana, the Venerable Rewata, the Venerable Ananda, another very well-known clansman. And on that occasion, the Blessed One was seated in the open, surrounded by the Sangha of bhikkhus. Then, referring to those clansmen, he addressed the bhikkhus thus, bhikkhus, those clansmen who have gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness under me, do they delight in the holy life? When this was said, those bhikkhus were silent. A second and a third time, referring to those clansmen, he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, those clansmen who have gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness under me, do they delight in the holy life?" For a second and a third time, those bhikkhus were silent. Then the Blessed One considered us. "Suppose I question those clansmen." Then he addressed the Venerable Anuruddha thus, "Anuruddha, do you all delight in the holy life?" "Surely, Venerable Sir, we delight in the holy life." "Good, good, Anuruddha." And just in case you don't know, Anuruddha was one of the cousins of the Buddha. And he had a very interesting story when he grew up. As he was growing up, his family were very pretty wealthy. And so he grew up, he just had everything he needed. And one day, Anuruddha was playing what they said was like marbles, a little child's game, with his friends. And he wasn't just playing, he'd make it more interesting. He would bet his lunch on the outcome of the game. And his lunch was some cakes or some pastries. And he lost. And so, not having anything to eat, he asked he had a servant, he was a rich person, someone to look after him, said, "Can you go back to the home and get some more cakes?" And so the servant went back home, bought some more cakes, he gambled them, he lost them too. And he went back a third time. That's the first time he went back, the second time, then the third time he went back and got some cakes. And the fourth time he lost them all. He's not very good at marbles. And then the fourth time when he lost them all gambling, he sent his servant attendant back, and the mother said, "We've got no more cakes. They're all gone. There are no cakes." And to understand the meaning of this story, I've got to introduce some more Pali now, and that Pali is the word natti. Natti means there are none. No, natti tea, natti dinner, natti whatever you want, it's not there. There is none. And so the servant was going back, thinking how to report to the master. There's natti cakes. But as he was going back, there was a really weird incident. According to Anuruddha's karma from the past life, he had been so generous in his previous existence that in this existence he'd vowed and had been accepted that he would never hear the word "there's nothing." What he wanted physically would be there. And so the heavenly beings, they thought, "Oh my goodness, we're in trouble now. We're going against the law of karma that this servant is bringing back an empty basket back to his master and saying there is none." And so what the heavenly beings had to do, they secretly inserted heavenly cakes inside that basket. Now if you think, I don't know what your favorite cake is, but if you think that is delicious, imagine what heavenly cakes are like. Oh, they are so scrumptious and yummy. And so, the servant never knew anything about this. And when he gave the basket to Anuruddha, he said, "Anuruddha, natti cakes." And Anuruddha opened the basket, and it was the most delicious cakes he'd ever tasted in his life. He didn't gamble them, he just ate them. And he said, "My mother doesn't love me. All this time she's hidden these most delicious cakes from me. Natty cakes are the best." And the reason why I tell that story, because you may have heard me tell that story before, when people say in Buddhism these what we call absence words, no death, no birth, the absence of suffering. Sometimes these absence words become a word in themselves. What it really means, there's nothing left, it's gone, finished. But with Aniruddha, that became the most delicious cake in the world. Nutty cakes. And it's also the same as the absence words of the Red Queen. He was a Red Queen in Alice in Wonderland. I just alluded to that earlier. Just when the Red Queen, or Alice, arrived at the Red Queen's square, and the Red Queen was waiting for her her messenger, and Alice arrived beforehand. So the Queen said, "Did you see my messenger on the road?" And Alice said, "I saw no one on the road. I saw no one." And the Queen said, "You got such good eyes. It's as much as I can do is to see somebody, but you can see no one. It's amazing." Then the messenger arrived. The Queen asked the messenger, "Did you see anyone on the road?" And then the messenger said, "No, I saw no one on the road." Said, "Yeah, well, exactly. Alice saw him too." But why are you so late?" And the messenger said, well, "I'm very fast, your Majesty. No one runs faster than me." "Exactly. That's why you came here first. No one came here before you." And they're just making this big sort of pun joke about nothing becoming a somebody. No one becoming a thing. Natty cakes becoming cakes. And all these other words in some of these deep suttas, when things disappear, the lack of consciousness. People think, that's a special state of consciousness. No existence. No bhava. We think that is a special type of bhava. And that is one of the mistakes which people make when we look at the suttas and we think that the ending of things is not just an empty state, a nothing state. We give it a name it doesn't really deserve to have. We give natty cakes a taste and a flavor. We give a messenger which saw nothing on the road, we see that nothing is some amazing people. Have you ever seen nothing? You've got good eyes too. So anyway, that was... I use that simile from Aniruddha, and I don't know why I get into that, because it's not in the sutta, so let's go back to the sutta and I'll behave. But Aniruddha is one of the great monks. The other thing with Aniruddha, I must say, just to add to this, which is, it is good. Aniruddha, when he became a stream winner, was 17 years after his ordination. 17 years. So when they say in no long time, you know, he saw the Dhamma, what they mean there is that 17 years is no long time when you think of all the many lives you've had. So that's why I say no long time. So please, 9 days. How many more days are left? 5 days. This took a great monk 17 years. So don't be disappointed if at the end of the retreat. But you've made progress, and that's the best. Anyway, so then he asked the Venerable Aniruddha, thus, "Do you all delight in the holy life?" "Surely, Venerable Sir, we delight in the holy life." Good Aniruddha, it is proper for you all, for all you clansmen who have gone forth out of faith from the home life into the homelessness, to delight in the holy life. As you are still endowed with the blessings of youth, black-haired young men in the prime of life, you could have indulged in sensual pleasures, yet you have gone forth from the home life into homelessness. It is not because you have been driven by kings that you have gone forth from the home life into homelessness, or because you have been driven by thieves, or owing to debt, to fear, or want of a livelihood. Rather, did you not go forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness after considering thus, "I am a victim of birth, aging, and death. of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I am a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. Yes, Venerable Sir. So it's not because you have to leave the home life or you're driven away by debt or lack of ability to survive. It's always done. People go off into the home life, into homelessness. They ordain simply because they find this is the way, the best way, to end the whole mass of suffering. In order to make more suffering, the ordination is not a path of more suffering, but of less suffering. What should be done? Now this is an important part of the sutta. What should be done, Aniruddha, by a clansman who's gone forth thus? While he still does not obtain to the rapture and pleasure that is secluded from the five senses and secluded from unwholesome state, which is the first jhana, or to something more peaceful than that, which is the second jhanas and above, desire invades his mind and remains. Ill will invades his mind and remains. Sloth and torpor invades his mind and remains. Restlessness and remorse invade his mind and remain. And doubt invades his mind and remains. The five hindrances. Plus, discontent, arati, invades his mind and remains. And weariness invades his mind and remains. Tandi. So while that is so, while he still does not attain to the first jhana, the rapture and pleasure that are secluded from the five senses and secluded from unwholesome states, or to something more peaceful than that. And when you first heard that, yeah, the jhanas are very powerful states of mind, incredible states of mind, but they exist, and the lay community, people in the lay community, experience these states of mind as well. So when they are abandoned, so when you do experience a real jhana, then what happens is the five hindrances disappear for a long time afterwards, for many hours. And that is one of the reasons why there's five hindrances. You see what they are here. You see they are a desire. Desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse and doubt. Those are the five hindrances. Sometimes, you know, when you want to see if a person really has had a deep meditation, how do you know? And you come to see me and say, I've had this really great experience. What was it? So Leha comes up to me and says this. And I say, you, women can't get jhanas. That's just a teaching thing, but thank you for reacting there, because I see if they really react, what are you talking about, Ajahn Brahm? Of course I can get jhanas, what are you talking about? If they react like that, which they're telling the truth, of course women can get jhanas. But what it is that I try to see if I can stir up some ill will. And if I can see the ill will come up, then I know, no, that can't be a jhana. That's all it is. I can finish this off easy enough. But there's another story which somebody reminded me, it's a Chinese story, of this monk. This monk, he went off into the island. No, first he went off to his teacher first of all and said, yeah, I know the basics of everything, I've been here and done that. Can I please have permission to be a hermit? There's an island not far from here, and it's uninhabited. I can very easily build myself a little kuti, a little hut. You've seen huts, you know, those who've been to my cave. You see how simple they are. And all I'll ask you to do is, can you send the attendant over, rowing in a boat, and give me some vegetables and stuff for me to eat, and just once a week to come. And then that'll be enough, you know, not much, but that'll be enough for me to survive. And if there's anything else I need, I can ask the attendant. and he can bring me back that those requisites the week afterwards. And so the abbot said, okay. And so he was there 3 years in perfect solitude, only seeing the attendant once a week. This beautiful island in the middle of the lake, perfect conditions for meditation. And so he's meditating there, and meditating, and meditating, and after 3 years, he had a big breakthrough, so he thought. His mind was really peaceful. Oh, it was so blissful and delightful. So what to do next? So he wrote, when the attendant came back, came in the boat, he wrote a letter. He said, can I have for next week some parchment, some ink, and a pen? I want to write some calligraphy. And so a week later, the parchment, ink, and pen came. And then he sat down and got into really deep meditation. And then he wrote his poem of enlightenment. And this was supposed to be in Chinese, but in English, it translated something like, the diligent monk alone for 3 years is no longer moved by the four worldly winds. And that's like almost like code. It's how people would say they were fully enlightened. They're no longer moved by the winds, praise and blame, gain and loss, all things like that. And then he let the parchment dry. He wrapped it up in a ribbon and he gave it to the attendant the next time he came and said, please present this to the abbot. A week later, the response from the abbot came. And the response was the same scroll which he had written. Alone for 3 years, a diligent monk no longer moved by the four worldly winds. And when he opened the scroll, he found out the abbot had written on the first beautifully crafted calligraphic line, the diligent monk, the four letters. You know what's coming, don't you? F-A-R-T. And it wasn't beautiful, it's like done in ballpoint pen or something. And it's on top of his calligraphy. On the second line, alone for 3 years, there was F-A-R-T in capitals. On the third line, is no longer moved. And there, F-A-R-T underlined. And the last line, by the four worldly winds, a really big F-A-R-T in capital letters, underlined three times, and three exclamation marks. And this monk thought, what? How can he do that to me? This is the poem of someone who's just been enlightened. This should be in some great monastery and just worshipped or put in some great museum. You know, this stupid monkey can't even understand what enlightenment is. Look what he's done to my scroll. And he went out of his little hut. The attendant hadn't gone yet, so he shouted out to him and got the attendant to roam back to the mainland. He stormed into the head monk's office, slammed the paper down. What do you mean? Please excuse me, I like doing these stories because, you know, it can be quite boring as a monk, you know, no TV, no internet or stuff like that. So. What do you mean? And the abbot just slowly stood up, put on his glasses, unfurled the scroll, and read out the scroll. The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the four worldly winds. Yet, monk, four little farts have blown you clean across the lake. Sometimes, to really find out if a person's enlightened or not, that's what we end up doing. Okay, I think you get the message. Let's go back to the sutta. So, when those jhanas don't occur, then the five hindrances, together with discontent and weariness, invades the mind and remains. But when he attains to the first jhana, or something more peaceful than that, or she attains to the first jhana, more peaceful than that, desire does not invade the mind and remain. You can understand why. Because beautiful happiness and joy, you're content. Who needs a desire? Remember those freedoms, the freedom of desire and the freedom from desire? You get in the freedom from desire. And with it, the opposite of desire, ill will. And when so you don't get what you want, you tend to blame others. Sloth and torpor. When desire is not there, of course, you've just got so much energy. Restlessness and remorse. Again, restlessness and remorse, sometimes it's just trying to escape somewhere. You don't need to escape. You're having a good time right here. Doubt. The mind becomes empowered. So what you see, you know, is not being distorted. And discontent and weariness. All those seven do not invade your mind and remain. So to make sure that it really was a jhana, that's sometimes what we do. That is so when he attains to the first jhana or to something more peaceful than that. That's the main reason why I read out this sutta. Just to emphasize this, but there's a passage in the end here which is also important. How then, Anuruddha, do you think of me in this way? The Tathagata, the Buddha, has not abandoned the taints that defile. The taints here, they're called the asavas. And it's an interesting word. You call them taints, there's some defilements. But the real meaning of it is the outflowings. And it sometimes could mean inflowings. But I prefer the outflowings, because you can imagine your mind being really peaceful in meditation, or say just in jhana growth. And sometimes the mind flows out into the world, out to the past, out to the future, out to your family, out anywhere else, except like staying inside. So that force which anyone can notice, called the outflowings, the asavas, you can understand what they really are and how they stop you being peaceful and just content inside. No. How, Anuruddha, do you all think of me in this way? That the target has not abandoned the taints of defile, being renewal of being, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future birth, aging and death. That is why the Tathagata uses one thing after reflecting, endures another after reflecting, avoids another thing after reflecting, and removes another thing after reflecting. And which is the best way of using these things? No, Venerable Sir, we do not think of the Blessed One in that way. We think of the Blessed One in this way. The Tathagata has abandoned those outflowings that defile, bring renewal of being, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future birth, aging, and death. That is why the Tathagata uses one thing after reflecting, like you use your robes, making sure you don't just use your clothes to impress other people, just to keep yourself warm, safe, and sometimes even the robes, not to show off, so that you can actually kind of disappear, so no one knows who you are. Just because you're a senior monk, you don't have special robes. I like that idea, because I remember quite a few times that the Buddha, no one knew who he was. The most famous occasion when he was this monk who'd ordained in the west coast of India, was travelling to see the Buddha. He'd never seen him before. He was ordained by one of the Buddha's disciples. And as he was travelling, there was a long way from the west coast to the Ganges Valley, and he asked to stay in this potter's shed, you know, for the night. The potter said, yeah, sure. Just like straw, but at least it had a roof over it and was safe. And then an hour or so later, another monk came, and he also asked if he could stay there too. Yeah, no trouble. So these two monks were staying there overnight, and This monk from the West was a very good meditator. So he started meditating, and the other monk who'd come also meditated. They meditated together all night, the two of them. And when the dawn came and had to get out of meditation, get ready to go on alms round, the monk who arrived second said to the monk from the West, "You're a good meditator, well done. Now, where do you come from? Who's your teacher?" And he said, "Oh, I come from the west coast of India. My teacher was this famous disciple of the Buddha. And I've never seen the Buddha, so I'm traveling to go and see him." "Oh, well done." And then the monk from the west said, "Well, who's your teacher?" And the monk who came in second, "I've got no teacher. I'm the Buddha." It is true. So, the Buddha, you couldn't tell that this was a Buddha just because the way he looked. And even he would just, stay anywhere. And I quite like that story, simply because it showed that the Buddha was not some special-looking person. In fact, a lot of time you wouldn't know who he was. Ordinary-looking, but deep inside was something much more powerful. So anyway, we think the blessed one in this way, the Tathagata has abandoned the outflows that defile being, renewal of being, give trouble and ripen suffering, and lead to future birth. So he just uses his robes like any other monk would use a robe. That is why the Tathagata uses one thing after reflecting, endures another thing after reflecting. Sometimes you get bitten by mozzies or something. Avoids another thing after reflecting. You just see a snake on the path, you go that way instead of over the snake. And remove another thing after reflecting. Good, good, Aniruddha, the Tathagata has abandoned the taints that defile, being renewal of being, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future birth, aging, and death. He has cut them off at the root, made them like a palm stump, done away with them so they are no longer subject to future arising. Just as a palm tree whose crown is cut off is incapable of further growth, so too the Buddha has abandoned the taints that defile, cut them off at the root, made them like a palm stump, done away with them so that they are no longer subject to future arising. Now sometimes people argue, said, "Well, once you're enlightened, can you go backwards and regress? Can you become unenlightened after that?" And the Buddha is saying quite clearly, it's obvious if you know what you're talking about, of course not. Once you've cut off rebirth, once you've seen through all of this, there's no way in the world you can just decide to get reborn. This is your last life and that's it. Why? The reason is your will has been seen for what it is. You've got no choice, it's just a natural process. Just like the palm stump, once the crown is cut off, it has to die. What do you think, Aniruddha? What purpose does the Tathagata, the Buddha, see when a disciple has died and he declares his reappearance thus? So and so has reappeared in such and such a place. So and so has reappeared in such and such a place. And the monks often say, sometimes they know the answer, but sometimes they want to explain it even further. "Venerable sir, our teachings are rooted in the Blessed One, guided by the Buddha. Have the Buddha as a resort. It would be good if the Buddha would explain the meaning of these words. Having heard it from the Buddha, the monks will remember it." Aniruddha, why I say that somebody who's died, whether get reborn, it is not for the purpose of scheming to deceive people, or for the purpose of flattering people, or for the purpose of gain, honor, or renown, or with the thought, "Let people know me to be thus," that when a disciple has died, the Buddha declares his reappearance thus, so-and-so has reappeared in such and such a place, so-and-so has reappeared in such and such a place. Rather, it is because there are faithful people, inspired and gladdened by what is lofty, who when they hear that, direct their minds to such a state, and that leads to their wealth and happiness for a long time. Now you realize this is where a person has gone to. And that gives you a lot of confidence. Here a bhikkhu hears thus. "The bhikkhu named so-and-so has died," the monk. The Blessed One has declared of him, he was established in final knowledge. It's not really knowledge, but wisdom. In other words, Arahat. And he has either seen that Venerable One for himself or heard it said of him. That Venerable One's virtue was this. His state of stillness, meditation was thus. His wisdom was thus. His abiding in attainments was thus. His deliverance was thus. And recollecting his faith, virtue, learning, generosity, and wisdom, he directs his mind to such a state. In this way, a bhikkhu has a comfortable abiding. It's one of the reasons why I said at the start of every rains retreat that it was Visakha, the great female, a lay disciple of the Buddha, who asked for so many privileges. Can I give robes and to all monks and nuns and food and special circumstances? So she would know every bhikkhu and bhikkhuni who came to the Sawati, to the Jade Grove Monastery, they would all have got something from her. And said, why only to you I give this privilege and no one else? And that's when she said, because I know that any bhikkhu or bhikkhuni who came into this monastery for the rains retreat and got a stage of jhana, a stage of enlightenment or these wonderful things, I will know I fed them. I gave them something. I helped. And when I remember that, they will give me so much joy and happiness that I know that that will be a cause for my own enlightenment too. And the Buddha understood that straight away and said, okay, you've understood. I give you that privilege. It's not just generosity for the sake of amassing things. Sometimes that generosity gets too much stuff. You have to give it away to others. But it's a fact that you're serving and helping others. And when those monks and those nuns, they use that wisely and they get a jhana. And they say, oh, I fed them. Yay! I helped out. I actually did something. Wow! It's like you're, if you like sport, like football or tennis, it's like you're the one you support, the team you support has won the final of the cup. You go crazy, yay, yay. And you've helped them. And that gives you so much joy. And that joy, you go and meditate, and whoa, that really works. You get a huge boost of energy. So anyway, that's why the Buddha tells people, so it increases their faith, so they too can do this. You say, like, a good example of that is Aniruddha. That's not Aniruddha, so Angulimala. Angulimala, he was a serial killer. He became a great arahat, a great enlightened being. Wow. But sometimes, you know, I get the question, usually in the evenings, can we, everyone get enlightened? And so there's a few people who can't. If you've murdered your mum or your dad, then that's called an antarayaka. So you can't really get enlightened in this lifetime. But that's about one of the two or three or four only obstacles which can't be overcome. But every other obstacle can be overcome. And I asked people, I said, how many serial killers are there here in this retreat? Any serial killers? If there's not, then you can become enlightened. And just saying that and giving examples of ones who did. Give an example of like the Patachara, the bhikkhuni, you know, who just went crazy and came into the monastery totally naked. And she became a great, not just a great bhikkhuni arahat, but a great teacher. Inspires. It can be done. And that gives you this marvelous when someone like the Buddha said, yes, they were fully enlightened. That really helps give you the confidence and faith. It can be done. Anyway, here, number 10. Here, a bhikkhu hears, the bhikkhu named so-and-so has died. A blessed one has declared of him. He was just, no. Oh, I've said that one already. Oh, have I? No, I haven't. What if it did number? Oh, that's, 11. I'm 11, yeah. Here, a bhikkhu hears us. The bhikkhu named so-and-so has died. The blessed one has declared of him the destruction of the five lower fetters. He has reappeared spontaneously in the pure abodes and there will attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world. He's either seen that venerable one for himself or you know, he knows about him and it inspires him and he directs his mind to such a state. If he can do it, so can I. And this way too he has a comfortable abiding. Or a monk hears, the monk named so-and-so has died, the blessed one has declared of him, with the destruction of the three fetters, the attenuation of lust, hate and delusion, he has become a once-returner, returning only once to this world to make an end of suffering. And he has seen, either seen that venerable one for himself or heard of him, he gets inspired, so he directs his mind to such a state. This way too they have a bhikkhu has a comfortable abiding. Here a monk hears, a monk named so-and-so has died, the blessed one has declared of him with the destruction of the three fetters, he's become a stream winner, no longer subject to rebirth in the lower realms, bound for deliverance, headed for enlightenment, and he's either seen that venerable one for himself, or he knows about him, he gets inspired, he directs his mind to such a state, in this way too, a monk has a comfortable abiding. Or here a bhikkhuni hears thus, the bhikkhuni named so-and-so has died, the blessed one has declared of her, she was established in final knowledge, an arahat, and she has either seen that sister for herself or heard it said of her. That sister's virtue was thus, her state of stillness was thus, her wisdom was thus, her abiding was thus, and her deliverance was thus, and recollecting her faith, virtue, learning, generosity, and wisdom, she directs her mind to such a state. In this way, a bhikkhuni has a comfortable abiding. Or here, a bhikkhuni hears thus, a bhikkhuni named so-and-so has died. The blessed one has declared of her that she's a non-return in the pure abodes, or that she is a once-returner, or that she is a stream winner. And you've seen that bhikkhuni for yourself, and you direct your mind to that state, and you too have a comfortable abiding and get inspired. Or here, a lay follower hears thus, the man named lay follower named so-and-so has died, or the woman lay follower named so-and-so has died. I'm just abbreviating this to make a bit more time for questions afterwards. And declared of those that man lay follower or that female lay follower, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, they have reappeared spontaneously in the pure abodes and will there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world. Or you hear that with the destruction of the three fetters, attenuation of lust, hate, and delusion, you become a once returner, returning once to this world to make an end of suffering. Or you hear that with the destruction of the three fetters, you become a stream enterer, no longer subject to rebirth in the lower realms, bound for deliverance, headed for enlightenment. You ever seen that in that lame woman or lame man for yourself? You heard it said of them, and that inspires you. And recollecting the faith, virtue, learning, generosity, and wisdom of that lay follower, you direct his mind to similar states. And that way, to a man lay follower, a woman lay follower, has a comfortable abiding. That's why the Buddha was announcing where those people have got to. And did you notice something? It wasn't a typo. There was no mention of lay followers. Buddha said the lay follower got fully enlightened. Why? Guru has actually said that if a lay follower, if you do really see the Dhamma, really see it as an arahat, fully enlightened, then you've got no choice. This is what happens in enlightenment. Choice, will is seen for what it is, it becomes a process. This is what happens. Either you have to ordain, you've got no choice, or you pass away. Why do you pass away?
You decide,
really.
Desires. Well, there's no desires. There's nothing to do. Why didn't the Buddha pass away? He had no desires to. Okay, very good. You've heard me teach before. He had something to do for others, something worthwhile. And they always say this. And when I mentioned about Dabba the Malian, he became an arahat at the age of 7. And at that age, he was a novice monk. And why didn't he just pass away? It's because he could do something to help the Sangha. And his job, he had the finger which could light up. So he became the guest monk. So when visitors would come, he would take them to where they needed to go, around Rajagaha, up in the mountains, the caves and stuff. And he would know exactly where to go because he had his own like psychic torch. And so he had a purpose to do. And he also, later on, he volunteered to be the person when people invited the monks to go for alms round somewhere, he would make sure he would organize so it was fair for everybody. He was an enlightened being. So it was always very fair what he did. And so if there's something to do, a purpose for you, and then they would actually still remain on this world until there's no more purpose for them. And then, because the lack of will, they would just pass away. So that's one of the reasons why they often say this. And at first when I heard this, I thought, this is really weird. If a lay person becomes fully enlightened, they just pass away. Peacefully, calm, simply because there's no will left in their mind to keep everything going. And that was an interesting point. But quite frankly, for monks and nuns, how many of you would be very satisfied if at the end of the life that you've got to be a non-returner? How many of you sitting here would be, okay, non-returner, it's not a bad. Because it means that, you're just never going to get reborn again. That enlightenment is and no real suffering. The only attachment you have, I don't know if I should say this, okay, might as well. The only real suffering you have as a non-returner when you go to the non-returning planes is you just get very happy with your jhanas and attachment to those things. Okay, still attachment, yeah, we've got to agree to that, but it's such a fine attachment. Of all the things you're attached to in the world, that is not going to cause you much suffering. In the non-returners. And also a sense of self. But not that big. So anyway, that's what happened. And that's why the Buddha tells of the where people get reborn. Especially if they... There's one case where it was the king. I think it was King Bimbisara's. King Prasenadi's wife. When she died, that the king went to the Buddha and said, where she'd been reborn? And the Buddha said, please don't ask me till tomorrow. I said, why not? He said, no, just don't argue. Just come tomorrow. I'm the Buddha. Come on. And then following day, the king came again. Okay, where did my wife? She was such a good person, and she always came to the monastery, looked after you. And he said, oh, she's been reborn in the heaven realm. And she told him where. And he said, well, why didn't you tell me yesterday? Because yesterday she was reborn as a beetle or something. Only for one day. Why was she a beetle for one day? It was some really intricate karmic cause. But if I'd have told you then that your wife, who would actually meditate and get precepts and stuff, that she was reborn in a beetle, you would not be very happy with me. So I just told you, she was a beetle for one day, but then now she's reborn in a beautiful heaven realm. Just to let you know that karma is very weird. So if you wanted you to know where was your mum reborn or something, if I told you she was reborn, she wasn't reborn as a beetle, but if I said that, would you be happy? Not very, would you? So he just, said, okay, just ask me tomorrow. Anyway. Yeah, it's a long time in the future. That's okay. So anyway, this is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Anuruddha was satisfied, as with all the other monks, and delighted in the Blessed One's words. And at the end here, I just added this little statement from about ignorance, otherwise known as avijja. Because this is said, a first point of delusion, avijja, is not seen. I prefer the word, again, delusion, avijja, because this is not something which refers to how much you know. Because sometimes there's some very, very, very intelligent human beings. They've got huge amounts of knowledge and they understand what they're talking about, but still they haven't overcome much of life's suffering. They still haven't got much of a clue about what life is really about. And so such beings, I would never say they're ignorant, but I certainly say they're deluded. A first point of delusion is not seen, such that before this there was no delusion, and afterwards it came into being. Still, delusion is seen to have a specific condition. I say, because that delusion has a nutriment, a thing which feeds it, nurtures it, keeps it going. It is not without nutriment. And what is a nutriment for delusion? It should be said, the five hindrances. So the five hindrances are what keep feeding delusion. And the five hindrances distort reality. Things like desire, you see what you want to see. And one of those examples, ordinary examples, it happens to people. Sometimes you think, oh, Ajahn Brahm, you've been a monk for too long. But sometimes people fall in love. And sometimes the guy thinks, oh, I'm so lucky, I've married the most beautiful girl in the whole world. She's so charming, she's so wonderful. Then one or two years later, he thinks, what on earth did I marry her for? When they start to think about divorce or whatever. I've seen that too often. And when I see those people, they're great people. Why is it that, you know, we get deluded by desire and then we get deluded by ill will? And I think this is crazy stuff. Human beings are human beings. Beautiful qualities, there's some stupid qualities, just faults and beauty, just like the trees in the forest. But the reality is that sometimes that we bend the truth to fit what we want to see. And we get upset at somebody, or we see the two bad bricks in them, and then we want to go for a divorce. So both are wrong. You know that first book I wrote about opening the door of your heart? The first story there, the two bad bricks. Soon after writing that, I got this invitation from the Thai embassy, the Australian embassy in Bangkok. And the only reason I got that invitation, because there was four couples there. Those four couples, two were divorced and two were separated. And the four couples had read that book, and the four couples had come together again. Even those who were divorced, they were going to give it another try. They realized the reason why they got divorced. They're just seeing the two bad bricks in their partner. And that little story was really powerful for them. And the separated ones, they too saw, no, this is a really nice person I'm living with or I'm now separated from. They want to go back, and they did. And all four of the couples came together and paid the airfare for me to make sure I get to Bangkok. I thought it was really cute, simply because, you know, that story had a powerful result. So delusion causes divorce. It also causes a marriage in the first place. But nevertheless, whatever you decide in your life, that can happen. And so it is that delusion is fed by the five hindrances. And how do you overcome the five hindrances? The message of the sutta is, if you don't achieve those jhanas, get those jhanas, have some experience of them, those five hindrances play around in you. And sometimes you don't even see them. Sometimes you think you're enlightened and you're not. Which gives me the wonderful opportunity just to tell the story, for those who haven't heard it, when I became enlightened. Would you like to hear that?
Yes.
My fourth range retreat. It's a great story. I'm very fortunate. It's just, anyway, I'll just tell the story first of all. Fourth range retreat in northeast of Thailand. And I was knew my stuff, how to meditate, knew the Dharma and stuff like that. And so it's a wonderful opportunity when you're not senior, you don't have to do so much work, you don't have to plan anything. The monastery had an abbot, so I was just number two. And so all that freedom of responsibility, so I would meditate, you know, a lot of the time during the day, stay up late at night. And of course, there's nothing else you need to do. And food was still terrible, but you know, I could still manage it. And then one evening, just meditating in the evening, late at night, and there's sometimes you don't get tired. The meditation was really getting strong, sitting meditation, sitting, walking. And on one walking path, it was late at night, maybe 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning, we get up at three, but I wasn't tired at all. And then I was meditating there, just walking quietly, a huge energy in the mind, no hindrances I could see. And all these insights started coming, powerful ones, amazing ones. And that makes you so inspired, so energized. And then the big one came. Really big one. Oh, that was really powerful. And that blew me away. I thought, wow, another enlightened being in the world. It's amazing. And of course, after that, there's no possibility of sleep. I did go back to my hut, lay down for about 15 minutes, no sleep at all, just resting my bones, not my mind. And then went to the 3 o'clock bell. I didn't even wait for the 3 o'clock bell. I was up sitting before the 3 o'clock bell. And, you know, sitting there. And when the chanting, usually, or if you think the chanting here is bad, you should hear the chanting at 3:30 in the morning in this forest monastery. Because everyone's exhausted. Not me. Yo, so Bhagawa! I'm really full energy. It's lovely. And then afterwards, meditating, no sloth and torpor. Then we went on the arms round. And on the arms round was really beautiful. I knew my job, to give loving kindness to all those beings who had a great good fortune to put a lump of sticky rice into the bowl of a new enlightened being. Oh, they were so lucky. And when I got back to the monastery, it was weird. For the first time in weeks, there were two pots of curry. You usually just have one pot of rotten fish curry. That's what it's called, pladek. And well, it's made out of these rotten fish they keep from the year before, pickle it. I mentioned with the maggots in and stuff. And I was just really, got used to it, but it was not very nice. There was another pot of curry there. Please excuse me if you're vegetarians. I'd love to be a vegetarian over there. It wasn't vegetarian food. The second pot of curry they got from town, for some reason or another, was a pork curry. And it was actually just, smelled delicious. Special treat. And I thought, what's going on? And I realized, ah yes, the heavenly beings had intervened. There was a celebration of my enlightenment. Makes a lot of sense. You have birthday parties. Today is to have a, what's it, I think yesterday, to have people, what's it called, wedding anniversary party. And sometimes they come, special events, they come and bring special food to the monks and to the nuns as well. And so we got special food, and I thought, ah, yes, I'm going to really have a nice meal to enjoy my enlightenment. What happened next? I've never, ever, in all the years I was there, seen this happen. The monk, the head monk, he took, we had, you know, enough sticky rice ourselves in our bowls, you've seen that. And he took this massive 2 or 3 ladles of the pork curry. He didn't take any of the rotten fish curry himself. Even though he was actually a local from that village. He grew up on that. That's what he was used to. His local food. He never took any of that. He just took a huge whopping, he couldn't eat it all, whopping ladles of the pork curry. And I said, okay, it doesn't matter, there's plenty left for me. What he did next? What he did next was totally unforgivable. He took the pork curry and he poured it in to the rotten fish curry and with the ladle stirred it all up. Saying in Thai, man gan lui, it's all the same, it's all the same. And I thought, if it was all the same, why didn't you mix it up before you took yours, you hypocrite? I was angry. Understandably angry. But then I realized, enlightened beings don't get angry. And I wasn't enlightened. It was nice while it lasted. And I didn't care what I ate after that. If you ever want to know how a monk or a nun gets really depressed, be enlightened or think you are, and then you find out you're not. Now that is really depressing. Well, I didn't care after that. And I started to eat there, and I think I snapped back to bed and just lay down and slept. But it was a very good experience for me. So how easy it was to deceive yourself that you are enlightened. And it was, thank goodness, that monk did that. I don't think he did that on purpose. He didn't know what I was up to. But, you know, he just mixed it all up. And blah. So anyway, that's a story of how I wasn't enlightened, but thought I was. Okay. Any comments or questions? Yeah.
You mentioned about the five hindrances that can prevent us to get good meditation and into jhana. But then jhana, the one that suppressed the five hindrances. So how do you sort of...
How you do that with the other factors of the Eightfold Path. So if you have a look at, say, the Satipatthana Sutta, all those four Satipatthanas you do having restrained, having weakened Vinaya, Lokaya, Abhijja, Dhammasang, having weakened the five hindrances. And how do you weaken the five hindrances? From your sense restraint and keeping precepts. They actually serve for restraining those hindrances, weakening them. And how else do you do that? As it's said in here, that if you have something inspiring you've heard, and you, it can be anything but hearing a great talk from an Ajahn Chah, or a marvelous, and someone's been really just generous, not maybe with money, but they just want to come and help out. Somebody's sick and they make sure they look after them. Or they're just incredible, just say, like Leha just coming out to help. You know, how much money do you get for doing your job as a retreat manager? Zero, nil, nothing. Does it? Why do it for then? Inspiration, I hope. And when you get inspiration like that, you're going to get some huge amounts of rewards which you can't measure. Those are how the five hindrances are overcome, by the earlier factors of the Eightfold Path. And they're not overcome, but they're lessened, they're weakened. And once you've weakened them, then you find that there are times when they get incredibly weak. Sometimes they're strong, but a lot of times they're really weak. And those times, you sit down and meditate and you find, wow, it's working. All the times you meditate here, not every time you'll have a deep meditation, even when you really get into it. But there's sometimes the hindrances are really weak and you can really have that incredible deep meditation. It surprises you. It works. And you get really blissed out. Then you come out afterwards, maybe the next meditation may be a good one, then the bliss wears out until you really get good at this. And you zap those five hindrances for good. That makes sense? That's why you always have to do an eightfold path, never a onefold. Your precepts, they weaken the hindrances. So keep your precepts, be wise about them, and just be kind. The second part of the Eightfold Path is nekama, which is like renunciation. And that's not in it for you. You're letting go of you, your sense of ego. Kindness, beautiful kindness. Be kind to yourself and others. You don't want things, you don't know ill will. It's the opposite of those. And that beautiful kindness, that weakens the hindrances. And the gentleness. So when you close the door, you close it gently. When you make your tea, you stir the tea gently. Whatever you do, do it gently, kindly. And that is weakening the hindrances. Then one day, they're weak enough, you just weaken them a little bit more, get into a jhana, and then they're gone for hours. And that's the time you can really get into the deep insights. That make sense? Okay, so do it. Okay. Arahang Samma. There's another question. Oh, yeah.
Much of that sutta was about knowing that at that time there were Aryas, noble ones in the world.
Yeah.
Now, in the modern times, monks and nuns can't report such things. So, are there Aryas in the world?
They can't. They can report about others, they're not supposed to report about themselves. There is a little trick, okay. There is a little trick though. That's only a bit of a joke trick.
I would say, I wouldn't know anything.
Yeah. Yeah. So what you do, there are some people who say, yes, I'm enlightened, say themselves. If they say that, you know they're not. So how can you tell? You go and ask the people who live with them. Now that's one of the best ways. People ask me, was Ajahn Chah an arahant? Fully enlightened. And basically I lived with him for 9 years. And I don't mind saying, yes, I was convinced he was. Why? Not just his meditation and wisdom, but the thing which really convinced me was that time I was asked by him to go up to his room and get something from his room. And by this time, he was just a really, very famous, popular monk. And the queen would visit him, big generals would visit him. He could have whatever he wanted. Inside his room, it was so empty. And it was just a grass mat, not a mattress, a grass mat, a wooden pillow, and on a string line for a spare robe. And that was it. There's hardly anything there. And I just was, wow! This great teacher had so many disciples, and his room had just hardly anything. And I thought, that was somebody who had the opportunities, had the chance, but just rejected it and lived in perfect simplicity. Those are the sorts of things which inspire you. And the other way, there's many doctors in here, aren't there? So what you can do, because it's tradition at the time of your death, when you're about to die, your fellows in monastic life can ask you, you know, just how is, you know, what sort of meditations have you got? What stage of enlightenment are you in? And because you're about to die, you know, it's okay to say. So if you can actually get some potion, put it in my cup of tea, which makes it appear that I'm dying, and you can convince me that I'm dying. So Ajahn Brahm, I'm laying on the bed there. Oh, Ajahn Brahm, you're about to go. You can tell us now. What have you achieved? What have you achieved? What's your state? And then I sort of let it out. And then you say, ah, good. Okay, please forgive me, Ajahn Brahm. You're not dying. But we needed to do this to find a way of getting the truth out of you. So that's a sneaky way. But because I've told you, don't try, because I know what you're up to. Yeah, well, you give me another sort of, some adrenaline or something pumped in there, and I can suddenly talk. I don't know how you do these things. Well, you doctors don't do that, okay. Okay. Let's do the arahang now. Yeah, because it's getting a bit late. and I've got interviews to do. There you go, and go up there. Arahant Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami Sadhu, Sadhu, Sadhu. Yes, very good.